Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you have found us. It's America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And this week, we got a great guest. It's Paul Woodbury. He works for one of our sponsors, Legacy Tree Genealogists. He's the DNA specialist there. And he's going to tell us how he goes about organizing all of his DNA matches and the ethnicity and the kit numbers. If you've ever tried it, it's kind of complicated. But he's got a system that's going to make it a whole lot better for you and a lot easier for you to actually discover some things through your DNA. So that's coming up for you in about 9 minutes or so. Right now, it's time to head out to Boston, and the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org, it is David Allen Lambert. Hello, David.
Hey, Fish. It was very nice to see you the other night, even though I wasn't in your house.
Where were you seeing me?
I was on the Next Gen Network and the YouTube channel with Melanie McComb, the Shamrock genealogist, interviewing you for a change.
Yes, that's right. It was kind of strange to be on the other side of that whole thing, but she did a great job. I told her she should be in radio.
She can be my fill-in when I'm not here.
There you go. She would be a good fill-in sometime.
Absolutely.
So I just got back from a nice trip, went to Mount Rushmore. I mean, we did a big Western swing. Wild Bill Hickok's gravesite, went to Deadwood, South Dakota.
Oh, yes.
And went to Little Bighorn and saw where Custer made his last stand. Wow. That was pretty amazing. In all, I drove 2,137 miles in 5 days with my wife.
Well, I flew about the equal distance. I was out in Houston, Texas at the SAR Congress lecturing out there. And then I was at the Michigan State Archives where I gave two lectures for the Abrams Family History Seminar Series, which was great. Now I'm off to Pennsylvania tomorrow to lecture at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle.
That is going to be so much fun. And that's where you get to shoot the Gatling gun, right?
Thompson submachine gun.
Oh, much bigger and faster. All right.
Exactly. With World War II veterans, mind you.
I know. Unbelievable. All right. Let's get going with our family histoire news. Where do we begin, my friend?
Well, it's summer, and it's always a great time for family reunions, but most of us have had them for, a number of decades. How about 165th anniversary for the Siller family of Macon County, North Carolina, who have been meeting since 1853?
Isn't that nuts? They've been meeting every year right on through the Civil War and up to this very day.
Mm-hmm. They have about 250 living descendants of the family that still meet, which is great. I wonder if they've used social media to do such things.
Yeah.
That must
help
a great deal. My next story goes back a little further and a little further north. Sir George Yeardley was the governor of Jamestown Colony in 1616. He was later knighted by James I, returned to the colony where he died in 1627. This week, they believe they have found his skeleton. The burial had his hands by his side, which is indicative of a burial of a person of note. And the thing about it is, his skull isn't there.
Oh, who would take his head?
I don't know. Maybe they brought it back to England, perhaps?
I don't know.
This is going to be interesting. So Y-DNA, obviously, is going to come into play, and hopefully they'll find out if it is, in fact, the governor of Jamestown. You always love when you find things in the attic. I just recently developed a roll of film that I had kicking around in a drawer from 14 years ago. So my daughter, who is 15, this is her first Christmas, so that was a surprise.
Wow.
But how about if you had 450 interviews? At the Navajo Nation Museum in Window Rock, Arizona, they have over 1,700 reel-to-reel magnetic tapes done in the 1960s and 70s of all this oral history of the Navajo Nation that were done back in the 60s and 70s. Probably has interviews with people born in the 19th century talking about their ancestors. What a genealogical treasure that will be to have them all digitized, which is what they're starting to do right now.
Isn't that great? And save them and make sure they're available for everybody online to take advantage of. That is incredible.
Well, sometimes in our research, DNA has opened up a lot of avenues that we may have never thought we'd find. And a researcher, Adrian Abaddon, has found out that she is potentially related to a man who was one of the first to free his slaves before the Civil War.
Now, she is an African-American genie, and she was actually looking to find out where her African-American roots came from in Africa when she did her DNA test, you know, to try to get the ethnicity thing, but made this discovery, and it's quite a story about this European relative.
Right. His name was William Fletcher, and he died in 1827 after transporting his slaves back to Haiti, where hopefully they lived out their lives not in slavery. And unfortunately, he died on part of the voyage. We don't know to or from.
Yeah, because if he died too, then you can assume that the slaves died with him. So hopefully it happened after he dropped them off.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, you never know what they're going to find in the ocean. And during the Russo-Japanese War, which took place in the early 1900s, there was a battleship called the Dmitry Donskoy, which was scuttled so the Japanese wouldn't get it. But it has been recently located. On board would be about $1 billion in gold. So they're searching the wreckage now for the gold.
Wow.
So do the Russians get it? Do the Koreans get it?
We have another international incident well underway here, right?
Well, our blogger spotlight this week goes out to our friends at RootsTech, which have a blog at rootstech.org/blog. If you're going to RootsTech, you have a chance to meet myself, Fisher, and a lot of wonderful genealogists and speakers, and you're going to have a wonderful time if you go.
Yep.
So rootstech.org/blog. So if you're not a member of NEHS, we can offer you $20 off by using the checkout code EXTREME for, of course, Extreme Genes at AmericanAncestors.org.
All right, David. Thank you so much. As always, carry on, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, my friend.
Legacy Tree genealogist, and it just so happens I have the DNA specialist from Legacy Tree on the line with me right now, Paul Woodbury, our old friend. And Paul, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Fish.
You know, it's fun because we're always seeing more and more people getting into the DNA side of things, and it really helps to start charting stuff out. And I will say, by the way, that seems to be really one of the harder things to do when you get into DNA, organizing your test results and your matches so they make sense. And I thought maybe we'd talk a little about that today. Where do you start, Paul? How do you do it?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important topic because we have some unique challenges with DNA test results. With your traditional research, you find records, you can organize them into your file systems, and you can build off of that. But with DNA, it's kind of like hitting a moving target. It's constantly changing.
Yep.
If you organize your test results once, it's going to be outdated by tomorrow. And the other challenge of this is the massive amount of data that you have to sift through in order to get to what you're looking for. How do you make sense of all of this data and cut through to the most pertinent data for your research
question? You're stressing me right now just thinking about this.
Right?
And well, yeah, because you get to beyond fourth cousins as matches. And the lists are huge, obviously.
Yeah.
And many of them actually overlap. You have many from the same areas, and you might come through several different common ancestors. And so how do you categorize those, or do you even bother? Because it's kind of tainted by the fact there's a certain amount of shared ancestry through several different people.
Yeah, and so what I typically do is I try to frame my organizational efforts within the context of my research questions. Rather than trying to treat my DNA test results as a collection that I have to curate and have to go through and categorize everything, I treat it as a tool for achieving my goals.
Okay, so give us an example.
So, for example, let's go to stamp collecting.
Okay.
When I was a young man, I loved stamp collecting. And my mom would always get after me because I would have this stamp collection, and I would organize it all and get it all set up into my binders, and then I'd buy new stamps. And then I'd have to reorganize everything, and there would be an explosion all over the living room floor. And so that's kind of how we treat collections, right? You have new items that you have to put into your collection. With DNA test results, I'm frequently dealing with test results for clients, and I can't afford to every time go through that entire process of organizing everything because that would take up all of the research time that I have.
Sure. And what they're paying for sometimes, right?
Yeah. And so in order to cut through some of that background information, you want to certainly identify those close relatives, some of those individuals that are really close genetic matches. And this mostly applies to autosomal DNA test results.
Yes.
Because it's a little bit easier to organize why DNA, mitochondrial DNA matches. They're not so numerous.
Right.
But with autosomal, you want to focus on those closest matches, see how you can categorize those individuals into relationship categories. How close are they related? Are they sharing the amount of DNA we expect? And what part of the family are they coming from? I tend to focus on organizing my matches based on the known relationships to those individuals.
Yes, and that's kind of how I do it. I have a half-sister, which is very useful because I do most of my research on my dad's side. And then I have a full brother and myself, and we've all tested. And so I put our names at the top of a list, and then I put common ancestral couples down the side, back to about second or third grades, maybe sometimes fourth grades. And then I list the matches under my name, under my brother's name, and my half-sister's name to see how many of them are similar and maybe which ones we have uniquely.
Yeah, and I think that it's going to be different for every person, but coming up with a system like that to clearly categorize these matches and particularly do it quickly so that you can get to the real meat of what you want to be doing, which is actually solving research problems.
Yep.
The better that you can organize a system that helps you accomplish that, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are tools, there are tips, and you've got a few tricks too, I know, for keeping track. What are some of those things?
So it depends on the type of data. There are a few types of data that we organize as genetic genealogists. You've got your raw data downloads. Those are pretty easy. You can put those into file system folders,
yep.
Get a good file system set up to organize those. You get kit logins. I typically keep those in a single place on an Excel spreadsheet, single reference. It's where I know all of the logins for my kits are. I don't have to be searching in what email had that login information.
Right.
And, did I accidentally delete that? So those are some of the easier ones to get into an organized state.
And this is if you're like administering for other family members, which many of us who are really into this do, right? I mean, you must obviously keep track of your clients, but you must have a lot of family members you administer for.
Yes, I do. And so having all of those kit numbers and all of that login information in a single place really helps me to streamline my research process.
Yeah, good point. And how far back do you keep track then of people who you share matches with? To the fourth cousin level, or do you get into the fifth to eighth cousin level?
It depends. So what I typically do is I rely on some of the tools that are provided by the companies for organizing and interpreting data. And particularly, I like to keep notes in the company-provided tools. Each of the companies offers a platform where you can enter notes on a genetic match.
Right.
And you can enter that information. That genetic match is not going to see the notes you write about them. It's just for your reference. The challenge is that none of the companies have a great way to search those notes. They don't have a great way to organize those. So what I do is, in those notes, I include tags, either hashtags. I sometimes use Onentoffel numbers. I'll say, these people are related through numbers 30 and 31, which would be my maternal great-great-grandparents. And then I can use that to organize those individuals. What I do next is I use some add-ons like MedBetterDNA, which allows you to search notes, usernames. It allows you to search hashtags that you add to those notes.
Okay.
I also use DNA GEDCOM Client. And with DNA GEDCOM Client, you can perform automated scans on your test results that will give you a spreadsheet output for the Ancestry 23andMe family tree DNA data.
Wow. That sounds like such a great way to make it simple, because you're right. This is like your stamp collection if you don't do things like this, right?
Yeah. And what's nice about these Excel outputs from DNA GEDCOM Client is it will also scan all of the notes that you've attached to your genetic cousins.
Nice.
So
yeah,
you have
very
an
helpful
Excel spreadsheet that is text searchable, and I can search for any hashtag that I put on any matches. I can search for any on and toffle numbers that I've associated with particular matches. I can search for dates, places, names that I put in those notes for my genetic cousin.
Well, and this is big, too, because one of the things I've always been disappointed in is the fact, for instance, with Ancestry DNA, you can fill in a little yellow star and you can keep track of these particular people, but it doesn't tell you necessarily which branch of your family you tie into. And so to be able to put notes in there and to be able to keep track of them in this way is certainly a much better way than just saying, well, here's my list of starred cousins, right?
Yeah. One disadvantage, at least for Family Tree DNA, of this approach is with the DNA GEDCOM client scans, currently, as far as I'm aware, they only will indicate if there is a note. It won't give you the text of that note.
Ah.
But for the scans for Ancestry and 23andMe, it'll give you the text of those notes, and you'll be able to see what you wrote about those matches. And I think that leads to another important point in that when we're organizing our analysis on genetic genealogy test results, it's the same ways that we organize our traditional research. We use tables, we use written reports, we use observations about those matches, or those sources that we're using. So some of the same tools that we use for traditional research are excellent tools for organizing your thoughts, your thought processes for genetic genealogy research. Tables, writing up a report, kind of going through what you're thinking in relation to these matches, keeping a research log, keeping a correspondence log of the matches that you've contacted, when,
yes,
who's responded, all of those things that we use for traditional genealogy apply for genetic genealogy. Because DNA evidence is just one type of evidence, and we can use it just like we would any other type of genealogical source. If you do it diligently, as you treat each piece of evidence like any other type of genealogical evidence, and record what you've done with that evidence, either in the notes field or in a research log or in a correspondence log, that sets you up for success. And if you haven't done that in the past, it's okay. You can start now and reap the benefits of,
yes,
beginning to organize that information.
Absolutely. And when I finally started organizing things, I was finding, oh, look at this. I've got four descendants from a fourth great-grandfather that came out of England that helps to prove the line back to him. What a great thing. And hopefully someday we'll find somebody who comes in from behind him because he's a dead-end line at this point. Hey, I'm talking to Paul Woodbury. He's the DNA specialist with Legacy Tree Genealogists. How far back do you go? How much attention do you pay to matching cousins in your DNA test results? Do you cut it off at fourth cousins, or do you go beyond that into the big hole of fifth to eighth?
So I typically limit myself to fourth cousins and closer.
Yeah.
And that being said, I will start at the top of the list, and I'll keep going until I get to the answer that I'm searching for. And usually, by the time I'm getting to the end of the fourth cousins, if I haven't found really strong clues, then we turn to other research avenues and strategies like targeted testing, or we look at some of the traditional evidence that we may have overlooked, and we kind of, you know, consider some of these other things that might be a little bit more effective than wading into the weeds of those fifth to eighth cousins.
Right. That is tough, isn't it? I mean, you think about that. The reason I mentioned earlier that I focus mostly on my father's side is my mom's is really well established. And we have tons of DNA matches from her side, and there's not really anything I'm expecting to be any kind of surprise there. It's nice to be able to put together a tree of descendants from certain people, and that's useful. But as far as trying to break through, that's the harder thing to do, and most of that comes on my father's side. So like you, I mostly stick to fourth cousins because that means we share third greats. And sometimes it's kind of interesting because when I compare my matches to my brother and my half-sister, sometimes one of them will not share that match with me, or they'll come in as a fifth to eighth cousin to my brother or half-sister, where they come in as a fourth cousin to me, and then it gets a little complicated.
Yeah, so once you get a little bit further down, you'll see that variation in the amount of shared DNA and the proposed relationships. They're far enough out that they could be related through that common ancestral couple that you've identified, or they could be related through another common ancestral couple that you haven't yet identified.
What do you do with somebody, for instance, you have a shared ancestor from the early 1600s, but you have another one from the late 1700s? Do you categorize that as a match to that later one?
At that point, I begin looking at Y-DNA and mitochondrial DNA, because it's just so far back for both of those levels of relationship that we don't want to rely just on the autosomal DNA evidence alone.
Got it. Got it. All right. Let's talk about triangulation now. This is something I'm thinking people are going, what? Triangulation? What is he talking about? This is basically the idea of determining where somebody is related. Who is the common ancestor and how is this done? And it's really pretty common thing to do. And pretty much anybody can do it. But nobody can explain it quite as well as Paul. So we'll let him do that.
All right, sounds good. Well, when we hear about triangulation in genetic genealogy, a lot of the times that is talked about in relation to the activity of chromosome mapping. We're taking the segments of DNA that I share with genetic cousins, and we're assigning them to particular ancestors.
Yep.
And we do that for multiple genetic cousins, and you begin to see some patterns emerge. And with triangulation in particular, there's a lot of misunderstandings surrounding this word. Sometimes people say, oh, I triangulated to this particular ancestor. Well, triangulation requires that you have three individuals that all share the same segment of DNA that they all three inherited from a common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
Match A shares that segment with match B, who shares that same segment with match C, who also shares that segment with match A.
So right.
You've got three people, they're all sharing on the same segment.
But match A may not know who the common ancestor is, and you've got match B and C, and they do know who their common ancestor is.
Yes, and so you can use that as a clue to determine that, you know, if since I'm sharing DNA with these two individuals who have this common ancestor, we know that I'm also related either as a descendant of that common ancestor or through an ancestor of that ancestor.
Right. Yes. Depending on how far back you're talking about. I actually had this experience with somebody I was helping identify a birth father line. And it was interesting because we took the assumption that B and C, they did have this common ancestor, that she must come through that common ancestral couple as well. And so went through and we figured out who her father likely was. And then to prove it, we wanted to try to find matches to that person's mother's line because the common ancestry went through the father's line with these other two people. And we were able to find matches from his mother's line, which showed us, yes, this validates this theory perfectly. And it worked out just great.
Yeah. So what's nice about triangulation is that you get a really strong evidence that you have all of these three people or more all descending from a particular common ancestor. The problem is that some people misunderstand that. They'll say, oh, well, I share DNA with this person, and that person shares DNA with match C, and so we must triangulate. In those cases, just because you share DNA with each other doesn't mean that you're triangulated necessarily, because you may not be on the same segment.
Right. You might not be on the same generational level, right?
Well, not necessarily the generational level, but on the same segment of DNA that you all three inherited from your common ancestor. You know, I could share DNA with match B, and I could share different DNA with match C, and match C and match B might share different DNA with each other. But if we're not all three sharing on the same segment of DNA, then it's not a true triangulated segment.
And this is where a tool like DNA Painter would come in, yes?
Yeah, so DNA Painter can be really helpful for identifying these regions of DNA where all three of us match each other. Now, that being said, as you're mapping, you want to keep in mind who the comparisons are to. If I am only looking at myself as the subject and I'm comparing my DNA to a group of other people, even if there are two individuals who share DNA with me in the same region, I can't necessarily assume that that's a triangulated segment because I have two sets of DNA. I have two sets of chromosomes, one from mom, one from dad, even though two matches could be sharing DNA with me in the same region, one could be on the paternal chromosome and one could be on the maternal chromosome.
Yeah, that's right.
So in order to prove a true triangulation, you have to perform a comparison between all members of the group to each other. You have to have me as the subject, match B as the subject, match C as the subject, to confirm that we all three are matching each other on that same segment. That is true triangulation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now,
absolutely.
The other scenario that I talked about where I share DNA with B and I share DNA with C in the same region, but they don't match each other, that is what I like to call overlapping opposites. And it's actually really useful because I can use that information. Say I'm interested in a research question on my paternal side, and I can identify one of those matches as a paternal relative. The other relative, because they don't match on that same segment to the known paternal relative, I can rule out as a maternal relative, and I can kind of ignore that match. So I can use it to filter matches and focus just on the ones that I'm interested in.
That's amazing stuff. Overlapping opposites. I wish we had more time, Paul. You're amazing. This is like sitting in a science class in high school. I didn't do well. I tell you right now. But we're going to keep working on it. I know a lot of people have a lot of fun with it. By the way, DNA Painter is free, and it's easy to use. Anybody can do it because you just copy and paste information in there. It is that simple. So check that out. Paul, again, thanks for your time. Fascinating stuff, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Thanks.
Time to talk preservation with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from tmcplace.com. And you know, lately we've been talking a lot about scanning to try to preserve materials and to be able to share them as well. But it's all part of preservation to figure out, well, how do we tell people what's in this image, what the significance is? There's so many things you need to attach to images. And Tom has some ideas on organizing after scanning. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm super.
So fill us in.
Okay, what you want to do is it's really easy to do. People get overwhelmed by so many things that we talk about, but this is a really easy thing. Everybody's probably heard of what they call a PDF, which is a personal document file or a portable document file.
Sure.
And they're really small. They look great. They're easy to make. Anybody can open them and use them and look at them and view them. And this is a good way to send all your photos to everybody in super small files where they can go and look at them, decide if they want some bigger ones and if they want to make prints, which most people aren't going to want. Then you store all the big files up in the cloud so your computer's not overwhelmed. You're not sending these huge files to everybody. All you need to do is combine them into PDFs, and it makes it so easy to share. And it's really important to go in and tag them so you can make sure everybody knows who they are.
Yeah, that's the part I think that a lot of people would be a little confused over. How do you tag a PDF?
There's a lot of different ways you can do it. In fact, usually what I do is I start with the raw file, and then I make a duplicate. Like we always tell people, before you start editing, always make a duplicate of it. So once you made a duplicate of your photos, you can go into Photoshop, which is what I use. There's tons of programs. There's Word programs. There's all kinds of things where you can go in and tag them and say, hey, this is Aunt Bessie. She was around from this date to this date. She related to us, however. And you can also do what we call hotspots, like with that photo that you found that had all the firemen in it, and you found a card underneath it that said who everybody was, and so you could find, oh, number 15 is so-and-so, that's my great-great-granddad or whatever. And another way you can do that, you can go into like Heritage Collector and get their software and make hotspots on all the people, so as you move the mouse over them, their names pop up. And if you have audio files and different things like this, you can also tag those to it. But the neatest thing is that way you can go in and document all these people and then create a PDF. And for those out there that have never done a PDF, it's so easy.
Very easy. Even I can do it.
Oh, absolutely. Anybody. Doesn't matter what your pay grade is, you can make PDFs.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's just a save as, and it's a real simple thing to do. You know, it's interesting, though. You mentioned the idea of making a duplicate first. And one mistake that I find I sometimes make is I go, for instance, maybe to change the size of a picture for a different kind of use. And then I go to save as, and I forget, and I do it as a save, and now I've lost the original picture I want. I think the thing that I've learned from that the most is that it's a good idea to come up with a completely different name for it as you make the duplicate. If you're doing it by name or something, list the last name first instead of the first name or something, just to make sure you don't accidentally save instead of save as.
that's a good way to do it, because a lot of people get crazy and they go doing things. They go edit, and then they close it and they go to open it again. And where's my original? What happened to my original?
Yeah.
Before I even open the program, I get the files that I want. I go and hold down the command key and then click on all the photos I'm going to be using. Then I tell the computer to duplicate those. Then all those are now highlighted, and the duplicates are what's highlighted. You drag those into a new folder that says edited on 1 November 2018 or whatever. Then when you go in and mess with them, you've created a whole new file, so there's no way you're going to mess up. But I do the same thing. If I open up the original, sometimes I forget to do the save as, and it just causes all kinds of nightmares. So what I found, you know, being Mr. OCD here, is I like to make them into a new file and open the new file, and then I don't have to worry about messing up the save as thing.
Tom, I know there are some people who just, you know, you talk about computers, they just kind of shrivel up and go, oh no, I can't do anything like this. But, you know, PDFs are really easy to make, and there's more than one way to do it.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the ways you mentioned in the first segment is if you're in any kind of photograph or anything that's on your screen and you go Command P or whatever your computer keys are to print, it'll go in and show you the option to print it to a file. And so if you choose print it to a file, it might give you several choices, or it'll default to PDF. But just choose PDF and then click on that and then tell it where you want it to go. You might want to set up a file that says My Family PDFs of my photos, something along that line. Then you've got all those in one special place. Another way you can do it is if you're on some kind of a site that has some pictures of your family, but you're unable to download them, you haven't figured that out, make them go as big as you can, enlarge them on your screen. And then like on a Mac, you can go Command-Shift-3 and they'll do a screenshot. On most Windows computers, there's usually a separate key if you have a real PC keyboard that says screenshot, and you can click on that. If you have any questions, just talk to a kindergartner. They can get you totally straightened out.
You know, it's a sad thing, but that's really true in a lot of cases. My mom used to say that we are the immigrants to this new world, and our kids and our grandkids are the natives. And they actually have to help us with this stuff.
Yeah, I consider myself pretty techie, but sometimes, you know, I talk to my grandkids and it's like, wow, they taught me something I didn't know.
There you go. All right. Once you've got your PDF, we've talked about some of the hotspots and how to mark some of the pictures and create that duplicate so people can see who's who. What are some other tips you've got for us, Tom?
Okay, let me give you a couple of sites you can go to. Of course, you can go to YouTube and look under preservation. Go to Heritage Collectors, and they've got several tutorials that are free. You can go and look at that will actually show you how to scan, how to make the PDFs, how to do the rollovers or the hotspots. They'll actually walk you through and show you videos. And then another thing you can do yourself is you can go to Adobe's website and download PDF Creator or PDF Pro, and then you can go and make your own PDFs. You have all these photos, say you have 100 or even 1,000 photos. You can go and turn those all into one PDF file and then go in and tell it to reduce file size so it's going to be small, and you can upload it, you can email it, you can do all kinds of cool stuff with it. So there's so many ways to do it. We just can't cover them all in this segment. So go to Heritage Collector, read their stuff. Go to YouTube, go to Video Maker, and just type in PDF as a search, and you'll find all kinds of cool things from Adobe's website all over the web.
And we should mention, too, PDFs are not really the kind of thing you want to make prints from if you're into that. But these are more like working pictures, wouldn't you say, Tom?
Exactly. It's more like you're just looking through a book, and you're not going to cut out a picture in your book and hang it on your wall. If somebody says, hey, photo 643, reel 1, I want to be able to do something with that, then you can go into your cloud account and email or share that photo with those people so they're not overwhelmed. They might have 1,000 photos, and there's only one that they're really interested in printing.
All right. Great tips as always, Tom, and you have a great week. Talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
Wow, we have covered a lot of ground today, and I've got to tell you, I'm going to have to go back and listen to the podcast of this show because I want to make sure I can take in everything, especially what Paul Woodbury was talking about as far as organizing DNA and making the most of all your matches. Good stuff. Of course, we have a free app that you can download for Extreme Genes. You can find it in your phone store for both Android and iPhone, and you can catch the podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, and don't forget to sign up for our weekly Genie newsletter. We got all kinds of great blogs there, links to stories that you'll be interested in, and of course, more great interviews. And of course, through our Patrons Club, you can get bonus podcasts twice a month as well, and all kinds of other benefits. Talk to you again next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.